Night is sort of the second half. If you remember a couple of months ago, I did sort of a tour through part of the archaeology and history of the Old Testament. We did from sort of Genesis up to up through Judges. And I think we're going to pick up at the United Kingdom here and follow us through to return from captivity. Most of the time we'll spend up in the front part because we're covering Ezra, Nehemiah, and Malachi and some others in the other classes, and so I'm sure that there'll be more in there. So we'll hit a couple of slides there, but not a whole lot in that part of the history. So I'll be presenting some of these things and talking a lot, but if you have questions, just, you know, raise hand or, you know, make an indicator at me or whatever, and I will try to answer them. I can't guarantee that I will, but we'll do our best to get that. Hopefully you'll enjoy it. And I'm going to need some readers. So I need somebody to start looking up 2 Samuel, the second chapter, verses 12 through 17. So who wants to take that one? Ken, you got that one. Jonathan, would you look up 2 Kings, the 10th chapter, verses 28 to 31? It'll be a few minutes before we get there, but that'll be yours, okay? And Penn, did you want to read one too? Okay, that'll be 2 Kings, the 16th chapter, verses 5 through 9, and then just one more I think will do us for tonight, and that'll be in 2 Kings, the 25th chapter. Who wants to take that one? Okay, 2 Kings 25, verses 8 through 12 when we get there. And you all have to remember who volunteered, because I won't by the time we get down here. All right, just a couple more coming in. And why don't we go ahead and have a word of prayer, and then we'll get started. Mark?
Father, we thank you for this day. It's been a beautiful week, and we thank you, Lord, for the opportunities that you've given us this week to serve you in the life, Father. We thank you for this place that we have to come together to study more about you, study your word, the good things that you have for us, Father. We're so thankful. Those who are sick and couldn't be here tonight, Father, Tracy, Dan, Marshall, Lisa, Barbara, and all those sick and health problems, as you continue to be with them, our children, Lord, we ask that you give us safe travel to our homes tonight. Thank you for your Son, as always, in his name we pray.
Amen. Thought the mics were fixing to do feedback there for a second with the helicopter going over. Benjamin, in my case that's somewhere at your feet, there's a laser pointer in there that I'll need eventually. It's up in the front part of the zipper pocket there. Okay. As most everybody knows, I like history. And it's kind of interesting when you start looking at these things to go through and see what people have sort of dug up and see how it fits in with the biblical narrative. Thank you. And sometimes it can be surprising results. Other times there's not a lot of controversy. So we'll cover both of those tonight. And some of the pictures that you'll see, I'll just caveat ahead of time. Some of them I have taken. Some of them I've gotten off of Biblical Archaeology Review, my favorite magazine. Others come off the web, and I don't remember exactly which all or which sorts, except for the ones I've taken. But other than that, you can find a lot of these pictures online and things if you want to look for them. The period of history we're going to look at first is just a couple of things in the United Kingdom. So if we look at the United Kingdom, who was the first uniter, the first king over Israel? Saul, okay? And then who was he followed by? David, right? So we've got Saul and David, and you wouldn't think that that would be a lot of controversy over that, but it's kind of interesting. Saul was one of the ones who had the wars with the Philistines. And if you look at, in 2 Samuel, when Saul dies and David is mourning him, one of the things that he says is, "Let not the death of Saul be shown in the streets of Ashkelon." Why would that be important that they wouldn't say things about Saul being dead in Ashkelon and Gaza and those kind of places? Who ran those cities? Philistines, right? And so David said, don't let it be known there because the Philistines will rejoice. Well, The streets of Ashkelon are a little different today. Probably don't need to get the lights here at that point. Just the front ones. I think we'll leave the back ones on. And as you can see, this is one of the main streets going through. And the houses off to the sides and everything. The coast wasn't quite that far up when Ashkelon was a city. But the actual harbor, I mean, it was a coastal city, but the harbor is actually underwater at this point. And there's actually some underwater archaeology that's gone on there. So we know where Ashkelon is. We know where a lot of the cities that came about during this time period are located. And a lot of these artifacts that they dig up there are pretty well known and fit the biblical story. But occasionally you come up with something that people don't know about. And the city of Gibeon is one of those examples, and I kind of like that. So if you look, who's our first reader? 2 Samuel 2, verses 17 through 12 through 17 there. 12 through 17.
Now after the son of Ner went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon with the servants of Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul. And Joab, the son of Uriah, and the servants of David went out and met them by the pool of Gibeon. They sat down, one on one side of the pool and the other on the other side of the pool. And Abner said to Joab, "Now let the young men arise and hold a contest before us." Joab said, "Let them arise." So they arose and went over by the count, 12 of Benjamin and Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And each one of them seized his opponent by the head and thrust a sword in his opponent's side. So they fell down together. Therefore that place was called Helkath-hazzurim, which is the Gibeon. That day the battle was very severe, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David.
Okay. This event that's recorded there we just read was during the revolt after Saul died and Ish-bosheth tried to take over the kingdom and David was proclaimed king in Judah. They came to a place they called the Pool of Gibeon. And for a long time, people didn't think that Gibeon even existed. There was no record of it being called, you know, Gibeon. And so that was another one of those places where they went, the Bible doesn't really know what it's talking about. Now, this now is known as the Pool of Gibeon. This is the place where that battle took place. And you might ask, well, how do they know it was Gibeon? Well, this comes the fun part. Because up in the University of Pennsylvania, they have a pretty nice collection of, you know, bits and pieces they've dug up. And they found near that pool a sort of a wine distribution point, and all that's left is like cracked pieces of pottery. But on the handles, there's inscribed the name of the place, Gibeon. So here, all of a sudden, in about 1933, these things were dug up. Oops, you know, something that people didn't think existed, it turns out was a city that was well known. You might think that David should have been a very large historical character. But until very recently, there were no archaeological records that mentioned David as king of Israel. And if you look at a lot of the modern writers of archaeology, many of them talk about the David myth. You know, that he just was a myth. Until in 1993, so this one's a very recent find, they found this thing that they call from Tel Dan. Anybody remember what Tel means? It's hill, yeah. Okay, a pile of dirt. You can just think of Tel as pile of dirt. The pile of dirt on top of Dan is what that really stands for. And when they started excavating that, they found this piece that mentioned specifically the house of David. Now, of course, that was a bit of a surprise to all those people who, prior to this, didn't think that David existed. But of course, as you march on up through history, you wind up seeing things like a seal that has Solomon's name on it. I want to point out a couple things that to me are kind of interesting. What, if you look at this, the king here, and it's got Solomon on it and that kind of thing. And so it probably wasn't his, but one of his officials or whatever. You see, what country's influence would you see on something like this? Yeah, why? Right up here, right? Doesn't that look very Egyptian? Those of us who, you know, went to the museum a few years ago, we saw a lot of those winged things there. So in Solomon's court and some of his seals and things, the things they found, there are echoes of a lot of the Egyptian influence that was there. And that's because they were at a crossroads. Egypt and Syria to the north were constantly going back and forth. But here we have a seal from Solomon's time. And of course, Solomon was known for all of his building projects. And there's plenty of places in the Bible, like 1 Kings, the 9th chapter, verse 15, that lists a lot of his projects. And they have cities like Megiddo and Gezer. And these are all places that have been found. People go dig there and, have uncovered pottery and things like that that have the names of the cities. So as we go through and you see these names of places, and apologize ahead of time for some of the readings, that's always the most pleasant reading is when you've got lots of names and place names because they're kind of hard for us to pronounce. But you'll find that they're real places. And I encourage you sometime, just get on the web and punch some of them in and you'll dig up a lot of these pictures that are over there. Now, sometimes archaeology is a little, it's not an exact science. And it's difficult sometimes for people to come to the conclusion on whether something is real or fake. There's a big business in fake artifacts. This one is one that's still under consideration. It's an ivory pomegranate. It's out of carved ivory. And it is inscribed with words saying that it was belonging to the temple, and it's dated from the time period of Solomon. So this may have been on like the head of a staff or something like that that someone, one of the priests or someone would carry. But the Israeli Antiquities Authority, the IAA, claims that this is fake, but there's a whole bunch of other experts that have examined it and say that it's real. So sometimes we don't know. But do we have any doubts that Solomon's temple existed? No. There's lots of other things we can look at from that time period, but this is the only artifact that actually claims to be a part of that temple from the period of Solomon.
That, would some of that reason be because it all got carried off?
A lot of it is, things were destroyed and Solomon's temple was destroyed, and so there's not a lot left. And in fact, that was one of the reasons the Israeli Archaeology Authority does not think that one was real, or the Antiquities Authority, is it wasn't unearthed from an official dig. It came out of somebody's collection, which was probably bought on the black market. And, people, since there's a business in this, one of the things that you'll find is that people go in and steal these artifacts out of, the graves and tombs or whatever, and then resell them to people. And sometimes they're genuine. Somebody just dug them up, and sometimes they're not. And if they're not part of an official excavation where everything is documented, then sometimes it gets very difficult to tell the history of the thing and, where it was. And that's the problem with that one. All of the people who study handwriting, they think it's real. All the people who've studied, like, the dirt that's in the cracks, they think it's real. Israel Antiquities Authority said it came through a suspect dealer, so we don't think it's real. How do you weigh that? Well, sometimes you just don't know, but they're still interesting to see. So Solomon was the last of the United Kingdom. There's a lot of his building projects and things around, not much in terms of little things, but plenty that we can at least point to say that Solomon was real, David was real. And it splits. And as soon as it splits, the kingdom starts getting into trouble. So if we look at this next area, or this next era, kind of from 820 to about 700 BC, we find that the prophets are talking about the people that live in that era. In Amos, the 6th chapter, verses 4 and 5, one of the interesting comments that it makes about the people in Israel is that it's woe to those who lie on beds of ivory. Why would he say woe to those who lie on beds of ivory? What's the whole point of that statement? Yeah, these are people to whom luxury and luxurious items were more important than doing what was right and people. And I obviously got off. Ooh, I am a three ahead. Back up. We're at 2 Chronicles now. This is in Egypt. This is in the Karnak's tomb. And these little things here are what's called cartouches. They're like a little, it can be anything from a sentence to a paragraph to a statement or a single word in the Egyptian hieroglyphics. And three of the cartouches in here actually mention cities in the Negev that are part of the Shishak's attack. And if you go over to 2 Chronicles, the 12th chapter, verses 1 through 5, and I didn't have a reader for that one, but you'll find that that's recorded where the Egyptian king Shishak came through and destroyed certain cities. And some of the things that are listed there are actually listed at his temple at Karnak, where he sort of made a recording of his campaign. Everyone in history likes to write their own record, right? And so a lot of the things that we're going to see tonight are from the viewpoint of the guys who were the winners, so to speak, because they get to write their own history. And so the basic thing here is, I conquered everything there was to conquer, and everybody's subject to me now. And he lists a lot of other places, but it's interesting that we find listings from places in Israel. And then I had one other one I wanted to show. And during the same time period, we had Jehu, who came in and conquered or took over from Ahab. You remember? And he left behind a kind of a legacy there in Israel, but unfortunately, he was conquered by this Assyrian king named Shalmaneser III. And in the British Museum, there's this black obelisk of Shalmaneser, which shows a lot of his exploits and who came to offer him tribute. And guess who this guy right here is who's kissing the ground? That's Jehu. And these are some people that are bringing tribute from Jehu, and this, of course, is Shalmaneser, who's saying, oh, okay, you got some nice stuff, so I'll take it, whatever. That's the way the kings established themselves, is by making these kind of boundary stones, and they placed them up so other folks would see that, oh, yes, you know, I've done lots of conquering, and these other people are paying tribute to me. There's a lot of other panels on that one that are kind of neat. There's a panel that's got camels on it and just people from all different realms. And you can kind of tell who's who by the hats and the hair and the dress a little bit. So these guys are the Assyrian side. You can see he's got kind of a pointy hat on, and a lot of the Assyrians had pointy hats. And then these people have different, slightly different garments on, the way they're dressed and that kind of thing. So I always like to call this the first photographs, right? I mean, they didn't exactly have cameras back then, so they'd carve all their stuff. I think it's going to be interesting, because how many people have photographs in their albums that have faded over time and you can hardly see or deal with anymore, right? Does that happen to just about everybody, especially the old film days and whatnot? I got some slides that I value that are hardly visible anymore, and that's just over a 10-year period. Yeah, look at this date here. That's stone. That's BC. You know, so that thing is almost 3,000 years old, and it's still got a pretty good image on it. So I don't think our modern-day photography is going to do quite as well as some of those did in the past. So as we move forward in time, and you get up to the divided kingdom, and this is where Amos was prophesying and talked about the beds of ivory, and there we have some ivory beds that were dug up out of Samaria. And these are very intricately carved. It was kind of interesting, because where does ivory come from? Tusks, right? Okay, of what creatures? Elephants, what? Yeah, like whales and just, you know, different things that have bone structure or things like that they call ivory. And it's a very hard material, and it's very hard to work with. And so all through time, carved ivory has been sort of a luxury item. And yet they found a lot of it up in the palaces and things there, in areas where around it were some very, very poor areas. And here we have Tiglath-Pileser III. Now that's one where I'd like to, who was our second reader, for 2 Kings chapter 10.
Your sons of the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel, God of Israel with all his heart. He did not turn from the sins of Jeroboam, which he made Israel to sin.
Okay, and I had forgotten to ask him to read that one. So that was about Jehu. And then as we move forward here to, oops, this guy here. Sorry about that. That's the next reading. That's the one in 2 Kings, the 16th chapter. Verses 5 through 9. Okay, so we have here the king of Israel sending to Tiglath-Pileser, who's the king in Assyria, asking him for help. And guess what this is a photograph of? There we have the Tiglath-Pileser III receiving envoys from that area who are asking him for help. So I think it's kind of interesting when you get a biblical record and a secular record that match very closely. And this is not the only one of those, but just a very interesting one that has pictures associated with it. And then we get down to the last king of Israel and the northern tribes. And these are little seals. It looks really big on this picture, but in reality, they're only maybe an inch large. What were they used for? Anybody know? Okay. This was a seal that you would use with wet clay to stamp on to show that that document was approved or had been signed by a particular official or someone. And they were unique. They were made for a specific person. They would have a unique design. And this one is engraved as it's Abdi, the servant of Hoshea. And once again, Hoshea was one of those characters that they weren't real sure about these last kings of Israel. You know, they kind of came and went pretty rapidly as you read the biblical record. And the historical record doesn't always include all of them. But once again, when they start digging through the trove of these things, and what's interesting is this is the seal. They don't find too many of those. The piece of clay that they seal it on is called a bula. And they have treasure troves of those because people, you know, marked lots of documents. And so in places where they would collect those documents or whatever, there'd be just piles of these clay bula that they can go through. And I might have a picture of those later. But this one is actually a carved gemstone with the seal denoting the last king. And once again, what major cultural influence do you see there? Yeah, see? That's very Egyptian influence at this time. Israel was trying to get Egypt to come and help them. But who conquered Israel? Assyria. They were to the north, and the Egyptians did not come up and help them. Okay, then we have the next big player along the line. This guy's name is Sargon II. Now, Sargon is another one, and this is a winged bull kind of thing. He was another warrior king in Assyria that had a big palace at Khorsabad, and these are some carvings from that. So we can see he was a, you know, kind of handsome-looking guy here, sword and everything in hand. And we see him listed as one of the kings that as we get down to the last bits of the United Kingdom, that Sargon was one of the invaders who was going to take the northern kingdoms down. So Sargon was finished off the battle from Shalmaneser, and then they began to move southward to work on Judah. That's a picture of the Isaiah scroll. Somebody was asking earlier about the Dead Sea Scrolls in one of our classes. This is one of the largest Dead Sea Scrolls. It's one scroll that has the entire book of Isaiah on it. I mean, it is an amazing thing. And well, what they did was, this is in an Israel museum. This building is made to look like a scroll container. one of those clay scroll containers. And, of course, that's one of the wooden things that it would look like the scroll was on, but, of course, it's monstrous size. This is the actual scroll going around here. And Isaiah kept records of that time period when the northern kingdom was falling. And so some of his recordings come out. And he lived during the time of Hezekiah. And Hezekiah, if we'll turn over to 2 Chronicles, the 32nd chapter, and we look at, beginning in verse 2, it says, "Now when Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib had come, and that he intended to make war on Jerusalem, he decided with his officers and his warriors to cut off the supply of water from the springs which are outside the city, and they helped him." And then if you turn over to verse 30, it talks about, "It was Hezekiah who stopped the upper outlet of the waters of Gihon and directed them to the west side of the city of David. And Hezekiah prospered in all that he did." Hezekiah dug a tunnel under the entire city of Jerusalem. And it was quite an engineering feat. And right where they had two tunneling teams that worked from each side, and right where they met, they carved an inscription in the wall. So, of course, the first archaeological team that went down there dutifully chiseled it out of the wall and stuck it in a museum someplace. So this is the carving, and Turkey wants it, you know, there's several places want it back. I can't remember where it is right now. But it's an inscription that talks about exactly this feat, and that it was Hezekiah who did that. Now, Hezekiah is getting ready for an attack from a guy named Sennacherib. And does everybody remember the story about Hezekiah and they're coming and they had conquered all the cities and they got right up to the gates of Jerusalem? Well, Sennacherib kept a record of his battles in that area. And we find it very interesting because, as I said, people write their own history. So here's Sennacherib's rendition of that battle. He said, "As for Hezekiah, the Judean who did not submit to my yoke, I surrounded and conquered 46 of his strong walled towns and innumerable small settlements around them by means of earth ramps and siege engines and attack by infantrymen, mining, breaking through and scaling. I brought out from them and counted as spoil 200,000 people of all ranks, men and women, horses, mules, donkeys, camels, cattle, and sheep. He himself I shut up in Jerusalem, his royal city. Like a bird in a cage, I surrounded him with watchposts and made it impossible for anyone to go in or out of his city." That sounds like a really successful campaign, doesn't it? What doesn't he say there? He didn't say he conquered Jerusalem, did he? Why? What happened? Yeah, the Lord delivered him by killing most of his army, and he had to turn tail and run. But Jerusalem was the last fortified city. He did those other things. He went through and conquered all of these other places. And in fact, there's inscriptions from the palace of Sennacherib that are his record, his photographic record, of all of these attacks. And especially the one at Lachish. The one at Lachish was the most famous. It was a very highly fortified town. The Jews felt like it would not fall, and it was a long, hard battle. You can see that the Assyrians here, this is Sennacherib sitting in his chair, overlooking the battle, and he's got all his soldiers around him. And I'm trying to decide if these are fans or fly swatters, you know, one or the other. To keep the king cool or to keep the flies off of him, something like that. But it was a tough battle. You can see they carried off a lot of loot as it was over. They had wagons full of goods that they carried off. Again, take a look at the guys in the pointy hats. The pointy hats are the Assyrians as you come through. Some of these down here are some of the defenders, and we'll see some of them in a minute. The pointy hat guys, they had slingers. It's kind of interesting because this is the way we know kind of how they waged war, is their records. We have nice pictures of it here. So these guys were slinging stones, and who are these guys? Archers, okay? So they're shooting all their arrows over the hills there. And this one's a little harder to tell, but you can kind of get it. You know what this little thing is here with the long pole on it? That's a battering ram, okay? And it's going up this siege ramp, and there's the wall of the city. These things they pretty much think are flying torches, okay? So they would light these torches and fling them over the walls and the defenders. These guys up here, they're the guys trying to defend the place, and they're having a hard time. A little further over, and the picture is kind of too blurry to put up here. There are lots of people sort of upside down falling off the wall. Who do you think all of them are? Yeah, that's the defenders of the city, right? And you can see the folks here trying to escape and trying to leave as they're carrying off what few possessions they can. The Assyrians were not known as really nice people. By the time this is over and you see the captives who are leaving, what do you notice about their cow that they're taking along? What's that?
Skinny.
Yeah, you can see the ribs in this cow. So they did a pretty good job of depicting that by the time this was over and there's a few people leaving Lachish, there's not much left to them. And it's mostly women here that are leaving and children because a lot of the men were just outright killed. The Assyrians were not kind people. And they were very good about recording how they tortured their enemies. So you wind up with this kind of thing here. We would call that impaling. What did they call it? Hanging. Okay, so for example, in time of Esther, who was the official that got hanged? Haman? Everybody remember the old expression, hanged as high as Haman? That's how he probably would have been hanged. It wasn't a noose around the neck. It was a stiff pole up through his rib cage to lift him up on high. They cut off people's heads. They flayed them alive. They ripped out their tongues. And were quite, you know, there's another one that has this whole pile of heads that they piled up. Why would they depict all of this there? What were the Assyrians trying to say? They were proud of themselves, but it's also part of their philosophy. And each culture, if you look at it, kings only want a few things. And so all you got to do is try to figure out how they're going to maintain those few things. What's the number one thing kings want? Okay, lots of good things there. Taxes is one of them. Lots of subjects. How do you get wealthy as a king? You tax the people. Well, taxes don't come in very well when the people are revolting, right? So, one of the things you got to do when you conquer places is figure out how do you keep the people from revolting. Looking at this, what was the Assyrians' philosophy for how to keep people from revolting?
Fear.
You make them so afraid because of what's been done to everybody else that they just won't even think about revolting because nobody wants to have this done to them. Okay, so they did a nice set of conquering things, and then we move on to the next set of period. Hezekiah over here. Yeah, me laser pointing at that screen is not going to help any. Hezekiah's over here. We had his, you know, dealings with Sennacherib. The northern kingdom is gone at this point. And we come down through time, and we're getting into the closing days of the kingdom down south as well in Judah. And one of the prophets that was left during the time that the Nebuchadnezzar was besieging the city and finishing his destruction of that area was Jeremiah. Does anybody remember who Jeremiah's scribe was? You can read it. Baruch, right? Okay, so if you go over the book of Jeremiah, you'll see that he had a scribe named Baruch. This is one of the bulas, okay? This isn't the seal. This is one of the clay pieces that was sealed. And so the other one was inverted, and then this one is the right side image. They had to kind of carve them in reverse so it would stamp right. Since it's in Hebrew, I can't tell either way whether it's inverted or not. This one was an interesting find as they were digging there in Jerusalem to come up with a seal that bore the name of Jeremiah's scribe. Nebuchadnezzar, when he was out conquering, one of the things that they did was set up these boundary stones so that it marked where the extents of their land were. And of course, he wanted to move these out as far as possible. And we found a number of these, archaeologists have, that depict, have inscriptions on it about where he's conquered and where he's going to and how great he is and the tribute that people bring. And there are boundary stones that indicate when you cross this line, you're in my territory. And so Nebuchadnezzar is a well-known historical figure. He picked up a lot of territory from his dad, Nabopolassar. And, of course, this is the Ishtar Gate. I think Marshall showed a few pictures of this on Sunday. This one is in the museum in Berlin, the Near East Museum there. And there's a lot of detail on these things. This was a very impressive walkway. But when you think about Nebuchadnezzar coming in, and he too went the same kind of route as Sennacherib did, conquering the cities along the way. One of the cities that he had to conquer again was Lachish. I'm not sure I would have wanted to live in Lachish. It was one of those places that just every time somebody came through marching to conquer the city, they had to get Lachish. This is one of the Lachish Ostraca. And it's really interesting because they had these watch fires that were set in all of the fortified cities. One of the ways that they communicated with each other was almost like smoke signals, except that they would set these fires. And then they would be able to, depending on the number of them, or blocking them, or letting them be seen by the various towers, you could communicate messages up quite a way. Well, when Nebuchadnezzar's coming, and they have a series of these towers along the way, what do you think happens as Nebuchadnezzar's marching? Yeah, all of a sudden, the far ends of the watchtower ring start disappearing, and they go down one by one. And on this, it says, "We are watching for the beacon from Lachish, following the signals you, sir, gave, but we do not see Azekah." This was somebody's letter back to Jerusalem, trying to give them an idea of the progress of Nebuchadnezzar's march. And he's watching for Lachish. They've already seen the other one go out, and it looks like they're fixing to be lost as well. So you get these very little poignant things. There's not much said there, but it says a lot about that march that Nebuchadnezzar did. And then we come to the end of the campaign, and I think Marshall mentioned this one again about the last king of Babylon. Of course, it comes up in Daniel, the book of Daniel, who's listed as the last king of Babylon there. Handwriting on the wall. What's his name? Belshazzar. Okay? Well, for a long time, people didn't think that Belshazzar was king. He wasn't known in history. And then, as usual, somebody digs something up, and this is what they dug up right here that has his name on it. Now, this is a different kind of writing than you've seen before. What do we call this kind of writing? Anybody recognize it? That's cuneiform. And there were several different languages. This is Akkadian, but it's cuneiform there. And this has been done with a pointed stylus as it stuck through. And I should have brought in a picture of the Rosetta Stone. That's how they were able to translate a lot of this, is you get some saying that somebody did in multiple languages at the same place, and there's several stones that are like that where they'll have cuneiform, Egyptian, you know, another language, and then it makes it easier for them to translate because they've got comparison that they can do on the language. What does Babylon look like today? Anybody remember what the prophecy was concerning Babylon? It was so great. What was the prophecy concerning Babylon? It would be a wasteland. It would be uninhabited. And a place where the shepherds wouldn't even take their sheep. And that's pretty much what it's like today. So they go into captivity. We're only going to spend just a couple of minutes on this one. But when they come out of captivity, we started looking at this last week, that Cyrus was one of the ones who let them go. And this Cyrus cylinder, it turns out that him letting the Israelites go back from the land, that wasn't the only group of people that he went back. You know, we were talking about the kings and how they planned on running things. So here's how you can sort of break down the philosophy of the major empires there. Assyria, fear, torture. Let's, you know, make the people so afraid that they won't revolt. Also, Syria deported a lot of people. Okay, we'll take the people from this area, we'll move them over here. We'll take the people from this area, move them over here. That's how we got the Samaritans. There was a little problem with that. What happens if you kill all the guys who are the farmers in an agrarian society? Yeah, what happens to your tax base? That's kind of tough. Well, basically, the Assyrians killed off their tax base. So that didn't work out real well. So the Babylonians came through, and they had a different philosophy. They said, well, fear doesn't work real well. So what we'll do is we'll take some young folks, like Daniel, and we'll raise them up to be good Babylonians, but since they're natives of the other land, then when they're really good Babylonians, we'll send them back there to be the governors and whatnot, and the people will accept them because they, you know, are actually their native folks. And it worked okay, but Nebuchadnezzar's descendants weren't exactly real up with that sort of philosophy, and it kind of decayed and whatnot until the Persians came along. Now the Persians, took a different view, and they said, well, okay, that didn't work for the Assyrians, and it didn't work for the Babylonians, so what we're going to do is get people back in their right places and try to make them happy. And maybe they'll produce good stuff and pay their taxes because they like us. And so one of the things that he did was he started writing these decrees to send people back and to rebuild their temples, because the Persians were not monotheistic. This thing that's recorded in Ezra about returning, that was just one of the ones that they returned to rebuild the temple. And I don't remember which one's written on this Cyrus cylinder, but it's a proclamation that was sent out so that people would know that this was from the king, that they were to rebuild the temples and to offer sacrifices there. And if you look at it, when it talks even in Ezra, it says that the king and his sons may prosper. Okay, so he was just trying to get anybody's goodwill to help out the Persian Empire. But there's an interesting piece here. Who invented the Pony Express? Anybody heard of the Pony Express? Where do we know that from? Yeah, the Old West, right? Okay, they had chains of horses along and people would ride through and whatnot. Guess who they borrowed that from? The Persians. There's one of the capital cities of Persepolis. There's a Xerxes, who was the king in the time of Esther. And how did these guys communicate? Well, they communicated on this main road via the Pony Express. This is a Persian mailbag, and it still had a fragment of a letter in it. And so when Ezra talks about they sent a letter from Israel all the way back to the capital, it probably would have gone on this mail train. Think about it for a minute. If the king is one place and he's trying to control this big kingdom, how does he get his decrees out to the boundaries so that people know what the king wants? It's communication. And without a good communication system and a communication infrastructure, kingdoms fall apart. And if you look at nomadic tribes and things like that, like, you know, Genghis Khan, when he was conquering, he conquered vast areas. Did he rule them? Did he keep them? No, because they didn't have communication. When he left, they were gone. Nobody knew what was going on. Alexander the Great, he established communication later, but the Persians were the one who really were the masters of it. And if you look at a map and see how big the Persian Empire was, it was mostly because they were able to communicate over long distances with things like a Pony Express and the letters that they sent. We've got tombs of all the people from this time period. Darius, Xerxes, Artaxerxes. There's Darius II, carved into the sides of mountains. These people wanted to leave legacies behind, and they did. And then, of course, Alexander the Great. This is the guy who followed along and kind of finished off everything for the poor exiles, leaving it to the Romans then to finally destroy what was left in Jerusalem in A.D. 70. Now, if we look at this particular picture, this is from the Arch of Titus. And there it is. I lost it somewhere. What do you see in this picture? What are they carrying? Yeah, what's this thing here? That's the menorah, okay? These are the temple treasures. This thing over here is from the temple, and there's one of the horns from the temple. You can sort of see the table that they're carrying there, which is probably the table of showbread. So when Titus conquered in AD 70, his guys took pictures, right? And carved them into the Arch of Titus to let us know that they had conquered the city and carried it all off. They did a little better job. The relief's a little better. So the camera technology is improving. But what's the temple like today? What's that? That's the Dome of the Rock. This is the Wailing Wall, which is the last of the foundation stones from Herod's temple, okay, which was the rebuilt temple that Herod did from the return and from exile. Herod expanded it, and that's the one that the Romans destroyed. But up on the Temple Mount, where the temple used to be, is now a mosque. Key to the Israelites wanting to return to their land is getting their temple back. And in fact, as I've mentioned before, in their Passover services, one of the last lines that you'll see in their ritual that they observe is next year in Jerusalem. They want a temple back on that mountain. I'm not sure that's going to happen easily. I think the Muslims would have something to say about that at this point in time. Why do you think that is? What was AD 70 all about? It was the end of Judaism. There is no more temple. All of that history up to this point is gone. Why did those people fall out? Larry, you want to get the lights for us there? Why was it that it came down to this? You've seen all the ups and downs. You've seen them destroyed. You've seen battles going. We've got records of all of this history. And most of it's not a great history. It's people fighting and killing and dying. And one nation after another conquering that area. Why? What did they say? They didn't obey God. They didn't obey God. And that same call goes out to everybody, really, that God has dealt with people who are disobedient through history in a lot of different ways. And he's still the ruler of the nations of the earth, so I don't think we can be complacent and think that just because we live in the 21st century now, and that we live in a great country like the United States, that this is a permanent status by any means. And a lot of these artifacts should be sobering from that standpoint of what can happen in history and what can happen when God says enough is enough. And then you become one of these just carvings left for future generations to find.